Welcome to the show. The Omnium Gatherum Music Podcast is designed to be an open conversation of all things musical. Each episode, your hosts put together a playlist of randomly selected songs to discuss, for you to listen to and enjoy in your own time.
Join Matt and I as we review, reminisce, and randomly run our mouths about whatever we want. And we want to hear from you too. We'll have segments that include special guests and listener participation so the conversation never goes stale.
Follow us on social media or pop by the website to learn how to be a part of the show.
And now, let's get it on.
Omnium Gatherum Musica.
Yeah, podcast. Welcome everybody to another episode.
Episode, we're not sure. 47. Episode,
question mark. It doesn't matter. Numbers don't matter.
Season 50. Yeah.
But just for anyone tuning in, I'm Gerald, and we also have your other host, Matt Kanoy, and we have a special guest today as well. You want to introduce your guest, Matt?
Yeah. So this is a longtime buddy of mine. We actually used to play together in the band The Grinning Man, JD Stalter.
Hello.
Welcome, JD. How's it going, man? Thanks for joining us.
This is wonderful.
Yeah, we just like to get together and just, you know, talk about the music that we love. We create a playlist to go along with each episode, or so far that's the plan. Yeah. We might deviate from that a little bit because we put together a podcast, or sorry, a playlist for covers. So we might have kind of themed episodes, if you will.
Yeah, but the plan is basically to talk about whatever the fuck we want and to do whatever right. we want. So there's not, I want to keep it kind of like free form, no like set structure or anything. But the idea is to have a corresponding playlist for listeners to listen to and enjoy in their own time if they would like.
You don't have an outline and an agenda?
No. not for this. This is supposed to be the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's any song that has really just kind of meant something to us, either lately or a song that we return to a lot. We just, for me, I always try to build a playlist out of songs that I keep coming back to for one reason or another.
Yeah.
So,
most of them. Is that kind of what your list is like this time?
Not necessarily. And so that's funny. I mean, I would say probably about half of them are songs that will just occasionally pop back into my head for whatever reason, because I just really love that song. But some of them are things that are just newer that I just recently heard. So yeah. I'm always looking for cool new stuff as well. So it's definitely a mix, you know, that's the feeling we wanted with the podcast, is just to be like a shuffle playlist where you really don't know what's going to come up next.
Yeah. A lot of, I can say for myself that a lot of my list is brand new stuff that I just heard recently, or that just recently came out. 'Cause that's just the mood I've been in, you know, craving new stuff. And that was another point behind doing this, was to kind of share that with, you know, everybody else. And maybe somebody listens to something they haven't heard before and they find something new that they like. So
I think it is really good to get out of your comfort zone. So I'll just talk about one of the songs that I included this week, or however often we do this, is kind of a curveball song, something I wouldn't normally listen to, or really, I didn't see myself enjoying that much when I first heard this song.
Yeah.
And it's also a band I don't really hear that often, but the band is called Ice Nine Kills. And it's a Kurt Vonnegut reference. So that right there kind of drew me in.
Yeah.
You know, my love for Vonnegut. And I'm also, I work with the Vonnegut Museum and the library. So that's something near and dear to me. So when I heard about this band, I thought, that's interesting. Vonnegut reference. I wonder what they're about. And
what is the reference, real quick, if you don't mind explaining for the rest of us?
So Ice Nine is basically a form of ice that I don't know, it's kind of
a form of ice as in like frozen water.
Yeah, frozen water essentially, but it's modified a little bit. So basically a scientist created this new form of ice that essentially just started to spread uncontrollably, just started freezing everything. So
Monster
it's
ice.
A doomsday kind of scenario of, you know, something that wasn't supposed to be destructive, but just sort of
turned
gets out of containment.
What book is that one in?
That's from Cat's Cradle.
Cat's Cradle. So, okay.
Yeah. That's one of Vonnegut's, I think one of his best. That'd be one that I point a lot of people to who have never read any Vonnegut.
Yeah. It's a starter Vonnegut book.
Isn't there an Satriani song called Ice Nine?
I believe so.
Nice.
I've heard other references to Ice Nine in music. Trying to think, because there's a hardcore punk band called Ice Nine. But I thought maybe it was the same band, and I was just maybe getting them mixed up or something. But it's this band is, not from the Indianapolis area. They're from California, I believe. At least they live there now.
Yeah.
But a lot of what they do ties into horror movies. So when I saw that they were big fans of horror movies, that also was something that intrigued me because I love a lot of horror, especially from that like 70s, 80s sort of the classic
golden
slasher
age
area. Yeah. And they did an entire album that's inspired by all the different movies from that era, like Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, the Friday the 13th series, Halloween, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they did each song in almost a theatrical style where they're basically telling the story of that movie.
Cool.
So this song, it's about a werewolf, and it's called Love Bites. And I love werewolves, even though there are not that many good werewolf movies for some reason. I just love the werewolf.
Yeah, right. What's mythos up with that?
I wish there were better werewolf movies, but it's also one of those things that I think is really difficult to make and not seem cheesy or trite, you know?
Yeah, which I think is why
there's a lot of werewolf movies. They're just not very good.
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot but there aren't a lot of good werewolf movies.
I think, in my opinion, some of the best werewolf movies are not very good, like cinematically anyways. Like maybe they didn't have a huge budget or whatever. So I guess you either have to go like, you have to either commit and be campy with it and make it good in other ways, or have a lot of money and be able to like, you know, show the transformation and
yeah,
have like a really scary looking monster or a scary looking werewolf in the end. Otherwise, I think you just have to be funny with it.
Are you thinking of American Werewolf in London?
Yeah.
I think he was referencing Teen Wolf 2.
I fucking love the Teen Wolf movies.
I love the first Teen Wolf movie. The second one's kind of...
Yeah, you're right. I do love Jason Bateman, though. What are those? The Ginger Snaps? Ginger Snaps movies?
I saw the first one. It's got kind of a cult following.
Yeah. They get worse and worse after that, I think, in my opinion.
Well, this song in particular, it has a theatrical, almost kind of like if a metal band also liked watching the show Glee. That's kind of what it feels like. But so, like I said, this is a curveball of something I never really expected I would like. But what actually really kind of stuck with me was the fact that they had this guest vocalist. She's normally an actress, and she was on the show Stranger Things. Name's Chelsea Talmadge, I believe. And when I heard her sing, I was like, wow, I like that voice. Mm-hmm. I want to hear if, because at first I thought maybe she was a musician and she might have some other material out there. So I went looking, and I don't think she's done anything else. So I was just like, what? That's so random.
That's her debut.
Yeah. And if you hear it, Chelsea, get, you know, record some more music, because I liked it.
Yeah. Come on, Chelsea. Give the fans what they want.
But yeah, so check that one out. It's kind of fun, just a little bit silly, but, you know, it's a good time.
Yeah, sometimes that's what you need, a little silliness.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we should probably explain how we go about doing this, because like the list that we share with everyone is just going to be like both of our selections combined. We usually both pick about like 12 to 15 songs and then put them together into one master list. And that's what we share with you guys. And then we just like pick a few of them to talk about. And then
right, we don't talk about every song on the list.
Right. No, that would take forever.
But we do want people to just, you know, tell us what they liked, what, if you've got any recommendations on new bands. We want this to be an outlet to discover new music that you may not have heard before. So I definitely recommend listen to something kind of outside your comfort zone, because you never know when you'll find a little bit of a diamond in the rough, if you will.
Yeah.
Do you have a song you wanted to highlight?
I do. And it's actually the Chet Faker song, Get High. Surprise, surprise. But I've actually been a fan of Chet Faker since like 2014, when I first saw the music videos for Talk Is Cheap and Gold, which both of which I really loved. And then I found his cover of No Diggity, which I believe is what launched him. That's what made him like internet famous. It's a really good cover. But it'd been a few years since he released anything as Chet Faker anyway. Which is a stage name or an alter ego, by the way. He did release some like experimental sounding instrumental music under his real name, Nick Murphy. But it wasn't super well received, I don't think.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I don't really know. I don't think there's a huge commercial audience for experimental music. At least nowadays with like the streaming stuff, and you know, I can't speak personally, because sometimes I do go to Spotify just to look for ambient music or experimental music just to listen to at the shop or like in the background. But I imagine not a lot of people are doing that.
Hmm.
You know, I don't know how much of an audience he had, or maybe people just were expecting more of what Chet Faker put out, which is more like funky, groovy, like more musical music, I guess. And
traditional music, yeah,
because he got pretty big as Chet Faker, and I think he just wanted to like bring up an old project that he was working on before. There was this really cryptic social media post in like September of 2020 after he was trying to do this Nick Murphy project, and it just said old projects die hard. And then shortly after that, he was releasing things with Chet Faker again. So, you know, he probably got a little bit of fame and money behind him and wanted to like do something that he started that he really loved, but then it just wasn't super well received by the general public.
Just kind of had to get it out of his system a little bit.
Maybe
the back of his mind or something.
Yeah. Sometimes you do have to just like blow your creative load before you can move on.
Well, I mean, that's pretty common. I mean, I think even Eric Clapton released some stuff as a another name at one point in time. It's not uncommon for somebody to like, all right, I've got this other project that does not fit in with what everybody knows.
Right. This project has gotten so well known that like it's kind of solidified in the audience's mind what it should sound like. It's not going to fit. Maybe I should just do this. Like Garth Brooks had his alter ego. What was it?
Chris Gaines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where he did more kind of traditional rock.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like, I'm sure just like, yeah, when Clapton did it, he did like a electronica thing when he was messing with that in like the 90s. You got Chris Gaines. And then, you know, you'll see what Sum 41 had their version where they switched and they did like 80s metal kind of stuff. So, I mean, those are just people are like, I don't want to be pigeonholed into one thing.
Sure. Oh, one project I really liked when a band, it was all the same members, but they switched instruments, you know, and you changed up the sound of the project was, the group, what's their name? It was a punk band from the late 90s who I'd still pick My Friends Over You. Do you remember that song?
Oh, Newfound Glory.
Newfound Glory.
Newfound Glory. Yeah.
I couldn't come up with it.
Oh yeah, what was their alter project?
They did it like a hardcore punk band kind of thing. And it was called International Superheroes of Hardcore. I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, something like that. Well, and a couple of them had been in some hardcore bands before.
Yeah. Yeah. You could tell it wasn't their first time playing it. Like they picked it up. So, or if it was, it was impressive that they could do it so well.
Right.
But they have a song about Madball, one of the like premier hardcore bands from New York who've been around pretty much since the beginning of that genre in New York City. Like Madball's Got Our Back. And I was like, that's awesome.
Yeah. Then late last year, he drops a single as Chet Faker again. I think because the pandemic got to him, but, I think it was in a good way. Both singles that he's dropped, which funnily enough are called Low, and the one that I picked, Get High. They're both super laid back and positive. And
interesting.
Yeah, it's just kind of like funky positive vibes for troubling times. And I feel that on a personal level. There's even a nod to food delivery drivers towards the end of the song. It's great.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah.
We've talked before about the juxtaposition of the incongruous when you have like a happy sounding song but with sort of sad lyrics.
Yeah, that sad or serious, you know.
You mean like Hey Ya by Outkast? I think that's the best example because everyone thinks that song's super happy, but the song's about a couple, like their divorce relationship is ending.
Yeah.
A song that always occurs to me is Summertime, how it's like a minor key, but you've got sort of happy lyrics.
Yeah. I mean, and especially if you played a little bit of a slower tempo, which a lot of versions of that song are in, especially in the instrumental versions. But yeah, it sounds like it should be a somber song, but it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not lyrically. Somber, I think, is a good way to put it, but it almost finds some sort of in between space where you feel, I guess, a little bit nostalgic. So like you're happy, but sad at the same time.
Yeah. And you can hold those two emotions at the same time. It's complicated.
Sure. Yeah. I love the feeling that song brings.
So, what's next?
Wait, hold on. Before you do that, there's one thing that you need to check out because it's right up your alley.
Yeah.
So there's this band called Cosmic Monster out of New Jersey. And this guy, the first time I heard him was on a surf compilation. It's a lot more like cinematic sounding, but it was something that Daikaiju put together. Cool. And he does some really cool sounding stuff. There's the Cosmic Monster, like,
self-titled thing. There's a thing on there called Electric Battle Masterpiece, which is great. But he just put out, he's put out several things where it's like, it's supposed to be like songs to a movie that doesn't exist. But one of them he did, and this is definitely up your alley, and it reminded me, it's called Werewolf, Stephen King versus the Werewolf.
Yes.
Yes.
So check that out.
Awesome.
I want to hear that just based on that.
That's great. And that, I love that also the concept of songs for movies that don't exist.
Because yeah.
That's right along the lines of some of the concepts we've wanted to discuss. Like, we've talked about genres that don't really exist and we'd like to hear people do them. Or, you know, we're doing the fun game that JD introduced me to, the concept of just mash a celebrity name and a band name together.
The Bobby Knight Ranger.
Yeah.
From Knight Parks Ranger. And Recreation.
What was your favorite again, Matt?
So the best I think that I've ever heard is Pantera Reed.
Okay.
And that's from our buddy Steve.
Good job, Steve.
I got some on my phone. Let me pull those up. There's pretty good.
Bring those up. But yeah, we want to hear people's ideas for, like, if you've got some music that you want us to hear, please, you know, send it. We'll tell you about, you know, our email address later on where you can send us that stuff. If you've got any ideas, you know, we want listeners to be collaborators. So,
yeah, the idea is it's supposed to be a discussion between everybody.
Exactly.
So these are some that we have. We have Pantera Reed.
Yes.
Flock of Steven Seagals.
Yeah.
Thundercat Stevens.
Thundercat Stevens. Oh.
Fred Savage Garden.
Yes.
George Jefferson Starship.
Okay. Okay.
Thomas Jefferson Airplane. Betty White Zombie.
Betty White Zombie. I would listen to that.
Yeah.
Owen Wilson Phillips.
Nice.
This is one that you did. I thought was great. Minute Bowling for Soup.
Oh, man.
This one's a little bit of a stretch, but I still like it. Modest Mao Zedong.
Modest Mao Zedong.
That's pretty brilliant.
Nicolas Cage the Elephant.
Yeah.
I like that one. Missy Elliott Ness.
Missy Elliott Ness. Perfect. Go ahead.
No, what were you going to say?
I was just going to ask if Darth Brooks was on there.
Darth Brooks definitely needs to be on there. The next one is Mel Brooks and Dunn, actually. It was funny.
That's even better.
Steppenwolf Blitzer. Cardi B. Anthony. And Anthony Michael Hall and Oates.
There we go.
Anytime Hall & Oates gets into the conversation, you know it's a good time.
Hell yeah, Hall & Oates.
Yeah, I still feel like Pantera Reed is the reigning champion.
That's definitely.
If you've got something that can rival that, let us know.
Yeah. Something that's not on the list that we just read. No cheating, right. Obviously.
No cheating.
The first time we played this was on my birthday, and the best part was is after about 10 minutes, like all of us were standing in a circle, just like no one was saying anything, like nothing.
We were just trying to think.
Like, everybody was, we were drinking a beer, so at least we were doing something.
But everybody's like staring at the ground, staring at the ceiling,
trying to come up with something.
And then it would be about, you know, once every 30 seconds or so, somebody would blurt out something.
Yeah.
Nice. It's one of those party games that you have to think about real hard.
Like, ooh, yeah. How can I make this good? You know, because sometimes it'll be two bands. You're like, oh, but that's two musicians run together. It doesn't really fit in because it's celebrity and band or famous person and band.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it evolves into like band on band
action,
which would be fine to have,
which would be fine.
That's a whole other conversation of,
it's a whole other game.
What if these two bands merged together? What would it sound like?
Yeah, actually, I mean, that would be another cool thing to talk about.
There, we had that one. We had like that was Jack White Zombie.
Oh yeah,
Jack White Zombie is interesting.
That might sound pretty cool. Actually.
That might sound fucking awesome, actually.
Yeah, like
Jack White's actually a really good guitarist.
The Dead Weather style. Oh, I don't know. Don't get JD started.
Yeah. Well, from a non-guitarist perspective, I don't play guitar. I just am impressed by some of the things I've seen him do.
No, what my problem with that is that Jack White's not bad. It's just there's a lot of, I feel like there's a lot of people that would try to put him in a class that he doesn't necessarily exist in.
Sure, and I get that. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. No, it's just when you see like in non-guitar playing publications putting him in the same comparable list as folks like Steve Vai or Joe Satriani or...
No, and I don't think he would put himself in those categories, you know?
Yeah, you don't compare Jack White to Wes Montgomery. That's not really...
well, that's a good segue because I actually have some news pertaining to Wes Montgomery. So through the Vonnegut Museum, I have the honor, the pleasure to be helping create a Wes Montgomery documentary.
Oh, wow.
I was kind of surprised to find out that there's never really been an in-depth documentary about his life. And the filmmaker, you know, approached us, said he'd like our help with this project. And so we're going to support him financially, you know, and be a fiscal agent for this project, but got to see some of the behind the scenes work that he's putting into it. He's already been in touch with Wes Montgomery's family and gotten a lot of home videos.
Yeah.
A lot of footage that's never been seen before. And I'm pretty sure Coltrane it appears in some of it. And, you know, you've got like the kind of royalty of jazz music within his sphere, you know.
A lot of
You got to remember, it's like the guy that discovered him was one of Miles Davis's saxophone players. It was Cannonball Adderley, and basically was like, hey, you guys got to come get this guy and sign him. And so, and that was in basically the mid to late 50s.
He had already moved to California though, right? At that point?
No, he was still,
still in Indy.
He was still in Indy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so he was doing that. And then, Cannonball, I think, was in town playing if I'm remembering correctly, but then, you know, basically they grabbed him and signed him, and he'd been playing around with his brothers, the, cause they made a couple records as the Montgomery brothers, but they didn't really do a whole lot until Wes kind of struck out on his own that really, off and the jazz world took notice.
Yeah, it's just a hell of a player. So if you haven't heard any Wes Montgomery music, I couldn't recommend it any more.
Yeah, look that up.
Stunning guitar playing.
He's one of the few guys that I put on the Mount Rushmore of guitar playing because, you know, just like Van Halen, Hendrix, Robert Johnson, it's after he came along, people basically either intentionally tried to play like him or intentionally tried to play not like him. But yeah, but it was one of those things. Charlie Christian too. So that it was one of those things, like it's music wasn't the same after he, like, the first record, you know, that everyone paid attention to came out.
Yeah. I mean, you can just hear it once you are accustomed with some of his work. you see just echoes of that in so many other works. It's, yeah, it's really impressive.
Yeah. I think that happens a lot with music.
That was one other thing I kind of wanted to touch on was the interconnectivity or evolution of music, if you will. There was a quote from Utah Phillips, the old folk musician, who I wanted to, I don't have the exact quote. I wanted to pull that up, but I know I can at least paraphrase. He talked about a friend of his coming to see him and said, "You sing a lot of old songs. You can't just live in the past." And he told his friend, "I can go outside right now and pick up a rock that's older than any song ever written. I can come in and drop that rock on your foot. The past didn't go anywhere." Also, I really like the fact that he wasn't a fan of labeling things as like 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. He was
by the decade. Yeah.
This siloing of decades doesn't really mean anything. It's just a like journalist convention for kind of making it easier to write about something. But he's like, Vietnam War started in 65 and ended in 75. What does that have to do with decades? Nothing, you know. It's just a convenience that people use, but doesn't really explain much about the evolution of music. And I found that even more as I started to look into the background of musical evolution. I found a really awesome study done by it's called the Royal Society, I believe.
The Royal Society?
Yeah. Or that was the name of the publication that it was published in.
Mm-hmm.
They studied pop music from the USA. So basically the Hot 100 from 1960 through 2010 to see what they could glean about the progression progression is a bad term. just the evolution of music.
Right. Not to imply that like new music is better than old music.
Right. Because first, just kind of getting back to that concept of evolution, cultural evolution is essentially the same process as biological evolution. It just doesn't involve genes. It can often involve memes.
Memes?
Yeah.
You mean like the pictures on the internet? Oh, no, I'm kidding. You mean social memes.
Right.
Gotcha.
But there's been a lot of study about this when it comes to linguistics, but not a lot as it applies to music. And so I think there's obviously still a lot of research to be done, and that's starting to pick up steam. But one of the kind of big misconceptions that's out there is that evolution is some sort of linear process. And that's a big part to do, or a big reason for that is that march of progress depiction that you see a lot when people talk about evolution, where it looks like, you know, an ape down on all fours.
Yeah, going to a standing man.
Right. As it moves to the right of the depiction, then it's
a literal linear timeline.
Upright. Yeah. Right. And that is actually not a good representation of evolution. It does not mean progress in some linear fashion. It's all it is you have to have variation, and then that variation is inherited intergenerationally. It's transmitted, and there's a selection process. So making some variants more likely to be inherited than others.
Or, yeah.
So really the selection process has to do with the musicians themselves, but also their audience and their preferences. And sometimes it obviously can be influenced by cultural events or technology.
Yeah, or availability. I know there are some places that have very strict rules on what music you can listen to or make.
That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, I remember reading something about essentially what you were saying, Matt, with how music has changed, and somebody did analyze like the types of chord progressions that are used in pop music from like 30 years ago till now. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they were talking about is, you know, if you look at it, what pop music was a long time, you know, back in the 40s, things were harmonically more sophisticated than they are now. Like it's not most chord progressions in your pop songs, 1-4-5, maybe 1-6-4-5, you know, there's maybe 3-4 chords. Sometimes it's one, depending on what style of music it is, it's maybe just a loop. Maybe it's one loop, you know, it's basically, basically you have a one chord for your verse, one chord for your, however, if you look at what has changed though, rhythmically, it's gotten a lot more complex,
right?
Because with the rise in technology and the access to, you know, drum loops and drum machines that you can do electronically, there's a lot of pretty sophisticated rhythmic patterns that are going on inside the songs, where essentially it's a one chord vamp.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of instead of harmonic accents, it's now rhythmic accents.
Yeah, and that
may have to do with some of the way that music's put together nowadays, or in that genre, definitely. Anyway. You know, because they start with the rhythm, they start with the beats, and then usually lay melodies on top of that.
Yeah,
well, and that's probably due, you know, and it's definitely with a lot of it towards what the, you know, really what is your audience. And so it's like for popular music, especially anything that's going to be played in any kind of, where there's any kind of dancing, you want something that's much more rhythmically complex, you know. And you're not gonna, I mean, you're still getting, you know, your songs with, that's a singer songwriter thing that's making it through, but more often than not, a lot of it tends to be much more drum beat driven.
Yeah. And the study I was mentioning earlier, it talked about the fact that they call them timbral differences, but you have different chord progressions that have been more popular or less popular throughout time. One of the most popular is major chords that don't change at all throughout the song. So basically you get one pattern involving just major chords and just repeat over and over. That's been one of the dominant kind of forms of music for the past, I guess it would be 70
years,
something like that. Yeah. But that started to decrease, as you were saying, as the beat of the song got more and more to be the focus, if you will. You now see a lot of music that doesn't necessarily use any chords at all. A lot of times, you know, it's just different tones that don't always, you know, work in a traditional chord structure. And so here are just some of the things I pulled out of that study. It's a pretty in-depth study where they break things down into, they're talking about, it's hard to just define everything as part of a certain genre because there is so much cross blending of genres.
Right.
But I think they found a pretty good system for defining what should fall into a different category. They didn't really call it like they would look at country music more broadly than just looking at a subgenre of country or something. But they did occasionally delve a little more into a subgenre if it became the more dominant version of that genre at the given time.
Right.
So I just found these to be some of the interesting conclusions that they came up with. There was a continuous evolution of pop music, although there were what they would call rapid periods or revolutions where you had rapid change.
Uh-huh.
In 1964, 1983, and the biggest one, so they considered 64 and 83 to be minor revolutions and 1991 to be the largest.
91.
Yeah. And so 1991 ties in with why pop music really is basically the way it is today. That was the rise of rap. And they said there's some anecdotal evidence that people have said, you know, claimed that a lot of the rise of rap has to do with the popularity of the show Yo MTV Raps, which started in 1988.
Dr. Dre.
I mean, exactly.
Not
I was
the
thinking,
real Dr. Dre.
Who would have guessed that the Dr. Dre from the East Coast may have been more influential than the West Coast Dr. Dre?
Ooh.
I'm not necessarily saying that's the case, but there's some anecdotal evidence that you could make a case for it.
True.
I wonder, there was a huge shift in 91. You know, that's kind of like the period of essentially when, you know, hair metal kind of went away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think there was a large shift away from what traditionally had been on like
arena rock.
Yeah.
Kind of died.
Yeah. Yeah. You had a lot of the folks like Van Halen and Poison and Rat, and then some of the other groups that had been around in the 70s that they weren't really doing as much anymore. Some of those other arena rock things like Foreigner and whatnot. But yeah, there was an upswing where you get a lot more of this music that probably wasn't getting the attention before, like you're saying, hip hop, rap. And there's some pretty big records that came around that time that probably helped shifted that. Just like in 64, when you're saying, I mean, that was basically the beginning of the Beatles, right? And the British invasion.
The British invasion, yeah.
And then, 83. And then, that's what I'm trying to figure out.
It's interesting. They did kind of delve into what they think were kind of the causes. So the British invasion, they concluded did not cause the 64 revolution, but it was basically timed perfectly with what the trend of music was at that time.
So they got lucky.
They said like Beatles and Rolling Stones were really just perfectly on trend because music was already going in that direction for a couple of years. But the British invasion just had the most success, and so are really the ones who you can point at and say these are the people who were writing the best music kind of in that vein at the time. And that happens a lot with really popular musicians who we might think were very influential, and that's not to say that they weren't influential, because a lot of other bands tried to emulate what they were doing at that same time. But they were basically riding the wave, and they were on the front end of it, if you will. So they were just, you know, right there at the right time.
You know, no, that's a good point, because as you're saying that, I was thinking about it. because if you think, you know, about every 10, not quite, but 8 to 10 years, it seems like there's a big shift musically. And kind of at that end of the 90s, where kind of that alternative rock and some of the original kind of like the early 90s hip hop stuff kind of went away, there was almost like a vacuum, and there was kind of waiting for that next huge thing to come through. And there wasn't, I mean, there were a lot of other great musical people have come out that around that kind of 2000 timeframe, but there wasn't kind of that big one huge wave came out that along those same lines, where, like, you know, you had rock and roll in the 50s, and then in the 60s you had the British invasion, and in the 70s you kind of had that heavy metal arena rock kind of thing. In the 80s you then had
like new wave,
and you also had the hair metal and some of the more kind of R&B influenced. Yeah. And then in the 90s you had your grunge, and then the hip hop stuff hit. And then in the 2000s there was this vacuum, and there was a lot of things that came out, but there wasn't like one or two giant things that kind of came through. Sure. There was
they kind of talk about that in the study, as far as the 2000s being the highest diversity in music, in popular music. So if you look at periods of diversity, as far as what's the most popular at that time, this is not necessarily representative of the vast, you know, there's always been a huge diversity really in music that's out there, but they were limited to looking at the top 100. So
the most popular in this country.
Yeah. The time of the least amount of diversity was 1980s, like early 80s. And that was due to new wave, disco, and hard rock being the biggest genres at that time.
Was 83 because of MTV?
That's an interesting question.
Because I'm pretty sure MTV went on the air, like, I think it might have been January 1st, 83. Or if it was early, I'm pretty sure it was right around then.
That could be, because I know a lot of the early stuff that they showed had a more rock or new wave feel to it. You know, those bands definitely kind of exploited the ability to get their stuff out there, if you will.
Killed the Radio Star the first?
Yeah, it was 81 is when MTV went on the air for the first time. But you were right, it was radio. Video Killed the Radio Star was the first thing. But I would think, you know, a couple of years for it really to take hold, right?
Right. Yeah.
Nothing happens.
Not everybody would add it right away.
Yeah.
So I just found that interesting, that the early 80s were the least diverse as far as the most popular music. And then 2000s, early 2000s. Were the most diverse when it came to pop music.
I find that interesting too, because it seems like for being the least diverse period, there was something that came out that was completely new, you know. Yeah. But like, where this, as the 2000s being the most diverse, I don't feel like anything really new that we hadn't seen or heard before came out.
And that has a lot to do with the ways of making music. So the technology involved, and as production increased in the 80s. So this was another thing I found funny. I was thinking, if you would have guessed that Phil Collins was more influential on music than the Beatles, I don't know if a lot of people would have made that assertion before, but you could make an argument for it now because of like the gated reverb and drum machine stuff that he was doing on In the Air Tonight.
That was the drum sound of the 80s.
Yeah.
No.
The gated reverb drums is the drum sound of the 80s.
And that was dominant for about nine years, according to this study.
So by influential, you mean like what? How much it actually changed and how long it lasted. And yeah, I could support that argument.
it was just, that's what was dominating popular music at the time. And he was right on the front end of that. So.
Yeah. I think a lot of the things, the way that like the way the Beatles changed the way music is made was probably a little more subtle. Because some people made, because as technology was there, you know, they were adding, it was like, okay, you used to only have 2 tracks, 4 tracks, and then things were expanding. But I think it was changing so rapidly and technology was getting so much better just during the late 60s that you can't really point towards one thing, where when you're looking at the gated reverb, that was kind of that sound kind of took hold of a lot of the ways that they really produced music in the 80s, and that kind of became that sound of the 80s. And then in the 90s, there was almost that they're like, we're going to go completely opposite,
like of garage that. Sound.
Yeah, the yeah, it was basically the lo-fi kind of that, yeah. All that 80s alternative rock underground, like the punk. All the underground punk and hardcore, all those kind of things kind of came bubbling up to the forefront with a lot of the grunge stuff. And then everything that came through with all the 80s hip hop that came through. Mm-hmm. Where in the 2000s, I bet you one of the reasons why, and this could just be me talking from my own personal experience, but I bet you the reason why the 2000s are one of the most diverse is because that was in the post Napster. Kind of when music sharing services really went through, and a lot of people ended up with more internet. And so there was probably just this big diversity. And so, and there wasn't a one unifying kind of way that you could consume music the way that it was in the 80s, where it was like, right. MTV was the thing that was
the radio
driving a lot of it.
Exactly. You had a lot more sources now.
And, makes sense. Yeah, and with the rise of the internet and the rise of digital recording, there was a lot of record companies that popped up that could previously provide distribution that there's no way you could do it before. And now you could make records, like, as long as you had some way to record something to a computer, that bar, that threshold of what you need to make a record went less way down. Cost. Yeah. And so there was probably that for a good, 10, 12 years. And then it wasn't until things like Pandora and some of your streaming services kind of help, I don't want to say take back over, but change the way that people consumed music.
Yeah.
Probably, I don't feel like that really got a good foothold until about, the mid, 2015 or so.
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting. Study kind of cuts off in 2010, so we don't necessarily know since then how much has diversity changed in music. It's certainly there's a ton of stuff available, but when you look at the very top of the charts now, things seem to sound very similar, and I think that has to do with a more global audience wanting things that you can play in clubs, or, that's more of a driver for what music is going to sound like in our current era. And as I mentioned before, the audience is also a big factor in the evolution of music.
Of course.
They're the ones who really select a lot of what is going to continue into the future.
That's that selection process you were talking about in terms of evolution.
And I think eventually I want to keep trying to add to a playlist that will highlight the different, or not differences, that but the more similarities in music from not necessarily sure what point I want to start, but somewhere with when kind of R&B and blues, jazz in that period, when those were the dominant musical forms, and how that morphed into rock and roll. Because I tried to kind of pinpoint the start of rock and roll. I know tons of people have tried to do it and argued about it. But I found it interesting that one of the songs a lot of people cite as the original rock and roll song is Rocket 88 by Ike Turner. And so that kind of the story behind it, I'm sure you know this, JD, that as his band was traveling, I think to go record, their guitar amp got damaged somehow. And so it was buzzing, and that was basically this accidental invention of...
They were like, fuck it, let's go with it. We don't have time to fix it. Let's just do it like this.
Yeah. So it's a distorted guitar sound. And to me, that was really the only thing about that song that sounded different from anything else that was going on. It, you can even go back a few years and stuff. They're already singing about, we're going to rock this place or rock this joint or something.
Yeah.
But it's more... still considered R&B at that time, I think, because it was so similar to the R&B of the time, that where you've got saxophone being one of the dominant kind of taking the lead on a lot of the solos, but you also had quite a few guitar solos in that, and it's, you know, obviously in blues music as well, that sounded basically the same as the rock and roll solos that would follow after that. And it, to me, the only kind of distinction I can really find as of yet is that distorted guitar sound.
There's a similar thing with a group called Johnny Burnett and the Rock and Roll Trio, and it was the same kind of thing where the tube, like a tube, fell out of the socket. Like, it got dropped before the recording studio, and so it made it distorted.
Yeah.
And so that's also where, kind of in that period where the need to fill the volume of a room with sound was not being kept up by the volume of the amplifiers, and so they started turning them up louder and louder, and that's when things started distorting. And it was during that time period, because the loudest amps in the mid 50s were like the 20 watts. You know, 25 watts, maybe
practice amp these days.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and then you've got where it wasn't, it was maybe 10 years, not even 10 years later, in the early to mid 60s, like 61, 62, where Dick Dale went to Leo Fender and was like, I need something louder. And he created the Professional, or the Showman. Actually, it was the Showman. And that was the first 100 watt amplifier. So it was within a couple of years, I realized, like, we just need louder. And then after that was, you know, not too long after that, it was another 5 years where Marshall was making huge stacks.
Yeah.
And then it was a lot of it was just out of necessity to make the amp keep up with the musical style. And so that's when the volume drove it. But
yeah. So the technology a lot of times has a huge effect in a short period of time. That's kind of, you know, ties in with the revolutions as well. A lot. It didn't seem like there are very many individual artists or bands you can point to and say that these were the ones who really changed it at this time, because that to me was one of the interesting conclusions of this study, was that music has continued to move in different directions, and you've had a lot of people kind of working concurrently on whatever the trend is at that time. So I think in some ways we tend to, I guess, over romanticize the importance of individual bands or players and not look at the broader perspective of how trends often then just affect what those artists are doing. And I think really a lot of times what makes a great artist is that they can assimilate very quickly. They can kind of look around and see what is the dominant force at this time and figure out how to harness that. And
yeah, whether it's going along with it or going completely against it, because you know, you're trying to do something absolutely new. Mm-hmm. I think that's also valuable and also can create those kind of like little, those revolutions that you're talking about.
And just because you're playing something that's similar to styles that are already popular doesn't mean that you're not a part of what's new, you know.
Right.
You're adding your own interpretation into it. And I think that's where some of the coolest music comes from, is when a genre has already gotten a little bit established and then somebody comes along who can say like, oh, here, look what I can do with this.
Yeah.
Genre. And, you know, it's like,
what Kurt I can do Cobain. With these genres, like multiple genres, because some artists out there can operate within, I think, multiple genres or subgenres.
It's like, I was thinking of, just Kurt Cobain as an example of somebody who I don't feel like was particularly original in the style of music that he was doing. Because if you listen to what was before, there was a lot of music that was trending toward this sound of grunge, you know. Mm-hmm. But so you had like Pixies, Sonic Youth, Swans.
The Melvins. I said the Melvins would be in there. Screaming.
Yeah, Melvins. He had a lot of bands. But he was able to just make it commercially viable, but in a very entertaining way, you know. And that is a huge skill in its own right.
It's a talent too.
Playing that down at all.
Right.
Well, it kind of the same thing. Like, you know, in the early 80s, Stevie Ray Vaughan did the same kind of thing of what happened with grunge, where he was an amazing talent musically, like from a guitar player standpoint. What he did, he didn't come up with anything groundbreaking or revolutionary. But he managed to grab, you know, the Hendrix thing, Albert King, Lonnie Mack, you know, some of the R&B stuff, and mix it together. And because he came along at the right period of time, and had found a great mix of his influences, he could then go on and have a great career, and
definitely contribute a lot to the popular music of the time.
Yeah.
You know? And he's somebody who, you know, you just listen to it and you know there's something special about what he's doing, even if it's not necessarily that I haven't heard anyone else do this before. He's just elevating it.
Yeah. Like he's taken it and he was able to put it into a mixture in one place, mm-hmm. that maybe somebody else was like that couldn't do it because of whatever reason, but he had the talent and the drive to, and was just able to, and at the right, maybe the right opportunity to put it together at the right time.
Yeah. And that's, I love listening to music from all different periods and hearing, kind of looking for the similarities and realizing that there's not like a cutoff to where this music sounded completely different from this stuff. It's like there's a lot of continuity in American popular music. And I don't know. I for a long time, I think partly because I'm a child of the 80s, I had a less diverse musical taste, and it kind of makes sense to me now seeing that that was a not very diverse time in music. But I'm trying to, you know, open up, expand. And that to me is one of the points of this podcast, is just to look at a lot of different music, stuff that I might not necessarily ever think about listening to, but I'm just like, if I come across somebody, yeah, I'll hit play and just let it go and take a little time with it and not just immediately just think, it's not my thing.
Yeah. I don't like that. That's not something that I like or whatever. It's not my bag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hope so. I hope that, both you and I and everyone who listens can, like, you know, pick up on some new stuff and find some new things to enjoy.
One of the songs that you put on the list that I was so glad to see because I love the group. I don't speak French, and it's hard for, I had to look up how to pronounce the word and I still don't even know how to pronounce it, but it's like
Chevreuil.
Yeah. Chevreuil.
It's actually in French that means roe deer, like roedeer. It's a type of deer.
Yeah. A type of deer. Yeah. Uh-huh. There a lot of them are found in Canada, I believe, like colder climate. But the song is, it's instrumental.
All of their stuff is instrumental.
Yes, I'm pretty sure everything they do is instrumental, but it's kind of alternative rock, I want to say, but it's got a lot of weird time signatures.
Yeah, and polyrhythms.
Yeah, there are times when it almost feels like the song's about to fall apart.
Yeah.
They
bring it back. It,
yeah, they'll sometimes have a sudden shift in rhythm. I really like rhythmic based music. You know, I love percussion, and they have a really interesting way of using the guitar and drum, or guitar and bass and drums, all to lock into a weird syncopated rhythm.
It's actually just a two piece.
Seriously?
Yeah, I was so. That blew my mind. This is a funny story. I was looking for. I was trying to describe them to somebody, one of my wife's clients in the tattoo shop, and I was like, they kind of reminded me of Battles. I don't know if you ever remember Battles, but
yes, I love Battles.
The story of finding this band is we were going to Ball State, and a record store just opened, and I was hell bent on going to buy some new music, and I just picked out something completely random. I had no idea who these guys were or what it was going to sound like.
I was, if I remember correctly, I think they had that CD in like the dollar bin or something. Like,
yeah, it was definitely on sale. And, you know, I picked it up and we listened to it. I think we actually listened to it together and was like, this is fucking awesome. I looked up to see, I didn't think they would be on Spotify. Because, you know, I didn't know if they'd ever made anything else, if they'd ever reached any kind of fame or notoriety in Canada or anywhere else. But they were on Spotify and I was glad about that. And I looked up their little description and it said something about, it was making a bikini joke. It was like, much like a bikini, this is a French two piece. So yeah, it's just a drummer and a guitarist.
I guess I could. Yeah, I will. I can hear that now that I think about it, but I just assumed that there was more going on than that.
Because it feels like there's more going on.
Yeah.
I don't know if they use like loops or loop pedals or if it's just all done like in the recording process, but it definitely sounds like there's more than two people playing.
Well, I mean, again, with technology, there's so many things that people can do. Like I remember reading about, are you guys familiar with the band Royal Blood?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And that's a bass player and a drummer, but basically he runs his bass through an octave up pedal and then runs it through some guitar amps. So essentially it mimics having another guitar player. And then,
nice.
You know, there's a great jazz guitar player who I'm gonna murder his name, so it's like Gilad Hexelman or something like that. I cannot remember his name, but he plays with this group called I gotta look, it's like John Raymond and the Real Feels or something like that, but basically it's a drummer, a flugelhorn player, and him. But he runs every that he's been hired in several bands to play guitar where there's no bass player. Mm-hmm. And so he can basically kind of set things up so he can run like an octave down on certain, you know, on the low strings So it won't do everything. It'll just do some of those low strings so he can kind of do a faux bass, so right. to speak. Mm-hmm. And so there's ways that people have found around, you know, having this other member that maybe, you know, typically you would need them to be there to do stuff. But now that people have taken advantage of technology to supplement that other member.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not maybe go ahead, G.
I was gonna say that's not even the only two piece on the list. Black Pistol Fire. Yeah, Black Pistol Fire is also a two piece. And they find some interesting ways around not having that other member.
Another two piece I really love is Death from Above 1979.
Oh yeah. There's another throwback.
Yeah. Those guys are just fun, you know. Would have been cool to see them live. I don't know if they'll do another comeback or not.
Another comeback? The second comeback.
They've already had a sort of a comeback, but
yeah.
Where they played at Coachella, I believe. Not that I'll probably ever go to Coachella, but
our music festival is going to be a thing again. I think they are starting this year.
Yeah, music festivals will definitely come back. People love festivals way too much for that to die out. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see which ones kind of.
Yeah.
So I think Bonnaroo, you know, will be around.
There's going to be a huge appetite for live music after this.
You know, I'm wondering if there's going to be a lot of like new festivals popping up.
You know, I bet you after this, some people will have drive to get things done that they didn't before. Mm-hmm. And people have had a year to get creative and try to come up with something.
Stew on it a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, they were hugely affected by this. Like those type of gig workers and those kind of professionals who were in the industry, like they just didn't have any work for almost a whole year.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see do you get a lot of new blood in it, or is it going to be people who've been around for a while who just return to it like raring to go?
Yeah,
I'm sure it's going to be a little bit of both. Yeah. I mean, the other thing to keep into account right now is Fender and Gibson both had record sales years. If you go into a Guitar Center right now, there's nothing on the walls. They can't keep their stock in.
Yeah,
and because people are at home. And they're now's a good time now's a great time. I wanted to play guitar. Now I'm not going anywhere. I might as well do it. So I bet you in the next couple of years, there'll be another big boom in music, kind of like the garage rock stuff in the late, you know, after that mid 60s kind of thing where there was just huge appetite.
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope if anything, positive comes out of this pandemic situation, that's it, you know, some kind of boom in music in the music world.
Yeah, I think we're definitely going to see some really awesome artwork come out of this. Speaking of live music though, JD, do you got anything coming up? Or
we're starting to get stuff booked for this year. And you know, the one thing I can tell you is playing pandemic gigs when we're playing outside and doing live stuff, and this is why I have a lot of hope for everything, is the amount of people that came up and would just say, "We're so glad you're here. We're so glad that I missed live music." You know, and this was like, you know, 4th of July last year. So forth. And there were people that came up. So, and previously, you know, when I'd played, I felt sometimes like we were almost like a live jukebox, you know, people didn't necessarily like, they liked the music, but maybe this will give them a new appreciation for, for live performing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when I would talk to musicians that were, that are still performing, but they're, you know, they're in their early 50s or older, and they were telling me how music was like when they would play, and this is in playing shows in the 90s, you know, they'd get booked to play someplace for two, three nights in a row. And you know, they were making pretty good money, where, you know, I've been playing live music now for 20 years or so, and I'm essentially still getting paid the same amount that I did before.
Yeah.
And so maybe now after this, there'll be a rejuvenated, and I'm not complaining, but what I guess what I'm getting at is that I feel like in the last 20 years, because of improve, like to bring this kind of back, because of the improvements in technology, you know, now it's like anybody has access to literally any piece of music they want in their pocket through their phone, through the internet.
Yeah.
And 30 years ago, if you wanted to hear a song, you had to go buy the record, wait for it to come on the radio, wait for it to come on MTV, or go see somebody live that knew how to play the song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't have that immediate access to it. And so maybe my hope is coming out of this pandemic that people have appreciation for the hard work that people put in to play live music.
Yeah, because it's a lot of work.
And not even just, and this is what I tell people all the time that come is like, look, I will play anywhere for essentially free, but if you have to make me set up like a PA system and do that, that's well, and it's like, I'll grab a guitar and lug it. Yeah. And it's like, you know, that's a 4-hour gig is really a 7-hour job.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Probably even more than that.
Lugging the stuff, especially if you are having to travel as well. And then, you know, you add in travel time, you've got to load in, set everything up on the stage, you know, then you get to finally play. Then you have to tear everything down.
And that's just the time that it takes on the day of the gig. You like not even considering all the other practice time and everything, all the other hours of your time that you've put into just like creating this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. If there were more places you could play where they had like a decent back line already set up or something.
Yeah, the places I like, there was one place that we played and they paid just as well as every other place, but they had a great PA system. All I had to do was show up and set up my guitar. And they're like, will you guys come back? And I'm like, I'll come back here and play whenever you want me to.
Yes, please. We'll practice here if you want.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where, you know, in the attitude of the whoever the manager, the owner, whatever, like I've had some where it's like, basically it's like you go in the corner, just don't mess it up. You know, don't do anything to distract from people being here.
Yeah.
And then I've had other instances where the owners are like, we get done playing and they just are exuberant in the, when can you come back? Can we get you guys anything? Do you want something to eat or drink? Like they take care, like they take care of the musicians. And I was like, we need to play here again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just that attitude. And so hopefully coming out of pandemic, there'll be more people that have the appreciation for live music and will, you know, treat musicians as more than just somebody who's there to be a live jukebox, because the amount of times that I've been playing somewhere and you know, in the last couple bands I've been in, there's been a definite theme of what's going on. You know, there it's like it's not like we're doing some, like, well, we're going to do a Beatles song and then Taylor Swift. And, you know, there's some kind of cohesive theme. Mm-hmm. And the amount of times that I've had somebody come up and request something that I understand it, maybe it's your favorite band, but if you're paying attention, what we're doing at all, it's not whatever you requested. And I understand if you like that, but part of me just thinks like,
did you come here to see us or?
They may not necessarily even have known the band that they were going to go see, but it's that wanting it to fit into what your own preconceived notion of my favorite good artist, what they should be or something. I'm like,
right.
You open yourself up to different experiences and then you'll be surprised, like, wow, that was actually really cool, but it's not something I was expecting at all.
Well, it was like the last band that Matt and I were in together. We were an instrumental band for the most part. We had a couple of songs that had singing, but I mean, it was basically every gig, essentially, if we weren't playing some like a punk club or something, but basically every gig we had somebody ask us where our singer was.
Right.
So what I started doing when people would ask that, I'd be like, well, who's your favorite singer? What are your favorite lyrics? And 9 times out of 10, people couldn't come up with their favorite lyrics. Because they were basically treated like some of it was it wasn't real music because there was no singing. Now I know. Mm-hmm. That's not exactly what they said.
Mm-hmm. Right. That was just the general feeling they were getting off.
Yeah. And so,
it's just what they expected.
Yeah. And so to me, it was kind of one of those things where it's like you're saying, get outside your comfort zone, challenge yourself. And, we'd play some of these places that weren't necessarily a venue that it typically have an instrumental group, but usually by the time we left there, we had made at least one new fan.
Oh yeah.
And somebody's like, I didn't think I was going to like this, but I really like this. Mm-hmm. And so it was,
or you can be impressed with what a group did and not necessarily be a huge fan of their music, but just go, oh wow. Yeah. They really played very well or something, you can get something out of it other than just like having to absolutely love
everything. You don't have to become a super fan. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it could be even one of those things where maybe they're not, whatever they're doing, maybe they're not even the best musicians or the best songwriters, but whatever they're doing from a concept standpoint, there's been times where I've seen bands and I'm like, you know what? They're not necessarily pulling this off, but I really appreciate what they're trying out there.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A for effort.
That's sometimes that can be really fun. You know,
it's like watching a comedian who's trying to figure out what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you're not there yet, but you're gonna be really funny. Just stick with it.
Yeah. You're gonna be really funny.
Well, it's like,
I'm sure they would love to hear that after a show.
Almost.
Well, it's, and that kind of reminds, like, there's this, I remember Patton Oswalt talking about going to an open mic or hosting open mics. And that's what he's saying. It's like, you would get some of your people who are like, they're funny, but they didn't care because it was just kind of random stuff. And there was some people who really knew what they're doing, but he said his favorite people were those people that are still trying to find their voice. That's what he was saying. It's like, they're going to be really funny.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like that, where I've seen some bands like, just, you guys need to keep practicing and keep trying, but because you're not quite there yet, but I see where you're going and I hope you stick with it.
Yeah. And if you see a group like that, tell them, that was cool, man. And I can see that if you guys really stick with it, that you're going to, that would mean a lot to that group, I'm sure. But so I wanted to ask you about favorite live performances. Like either ones you've been involved in or just awesome concerts that you've attended.
Are you talking to me or JD?
Anybody.
G, you want to go first?
Ooh, favorite live moments? Well, I guess it would really depend on whether you're talking about whether I was performing or just there to watch. I think favorite performing live moments definitely happened with the Whiskey Riders. It was one of those like just pure rock and roll moments, and that only I could see because our singer was extremely drunk and overworking himself at the time. So he came back to the back of the stage right next to where my drum kit was and puked off the back of the stage while he was playing. And then like, you know, just like fucking whipped his hair back and then walked back to the front of the stage and continued to play this badass guitar solo and went on with the song like nothing happened. And, but I saw it because it was like right next to my face. And, I was just like, wow, that's fucking rock and roll. It just pumped me up for the rest of the song and the rest of the set.
That's awesome.
Wow.
That was Johnny Goble, Jay Blaze.
Yeah, man.
Off the top of my head, that's my favorite, but there's been so many good moments. I loved playing music live. I love seeing music live. You know, you and I have been to a lot of really good concerts together. We've seen Slayer, Motorhead.
Yeah.
Tool.
So one, as far as music that or concerts that I'll never forget is it was called the, oh crap. I don't know the name of the actual festival, but it was a hip hop festival in New York City on Randall's Island. And it basically had anybody like who you'd ever heard of in hip hop.
Was that Rock the Bells?
Rock the Bells. Yes. That's it. I knew it had Bell in it somehow. Thank you.
Yeah. It was like a wintertime festival, hip hop festival.
Rage Against the Machine headlined that year, but they had, like Mos Def, Talib Kweli. You had Public Enemy, Cypress Hill was there. It had, the entire Wu-Tang Clan.
The so entire, I mean, like, not just four or five of them.
No, like how many guys are in it? I'm not sure, but it looked like 13 people on stage or something. And like there was almost not enough room for them to move around on stage. Yeah. Even though it was a massive stage, it's still, they were just that many of them. It was sort of comical, but it was such a good show. And part of what made me think about of that recently was that I just watched the movie, Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai.
Yeah.
And
Forrest Whitaker, y'all.
The RZA did the soundtrack for that, which is really cool. And if you are into Wu-Tang or the RZA at all, check out that movie. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I watched a little bit of the behind the scenes. They were talking to Forrest Whitaker about his inspiration, and he talked about how listening to the hip hop that RZA had made, some other stuff that he had found to put on the soundtrack, and that was a big influence. And this kind of brought me back to when I was thinking about the study and how much hip hop took off in the early 90s. And I loved the way that Forrest Whitaker described hip hop as being like this aboriginal feeling music, like it that is cross-cultural, you know. And he related it, you know, to the African-American struggle to kind of get back to something that was more similar to, in a way, to the music, kind of the roots, he would say, of the music of from where they came from. Uh-huh. But a lot of music had kind of a spoken word type of story feeling if you go back far enough in pretty much any culture. So like Latin, talking about like the Roman Empire, some of their music was literally just basically poetry that was
recited over music.
Rhythmically, you know. And there wasn't necessarily even a musical accompaniment, just a voice. You know, you've got a lot of early music that was just voice. And so the tying it back into this idea of evolution, it's not necessarily a linear progression from one point to another point. A lot of times you end up seeing things cycle back and, you know, it gets back almost to its roots, if you will. Things kind of build up and then you can kind of break them back down. And I don't know. I just really loved that description for hip hop music. So I know some people I've heard say that it's not what they would consider a form of art. And I don't know how you could really say that. I mean, it's clearly its own genre, and like it hadn't quite reached artistic expression yet. And I'm like,
that is absolutely
what
false.
That even means. Yeah. That's that person clearly didn't think about musical history at all.
Yeah.
Oh, but one other thing this sort of relates is I know that at some point we want to start talking about our favorite concept albums.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea of telling stories through music, which obviously has been around from the beginning of music, but having a cohesive narrative that goes through several works of music is a little bit newer. When you, in the terms of a concept album, although I guess you could relate it to like opera or, you know, some other older forms of music.
Right.
So anyway, that's, that was a long tangent there.
That was a long one. Good job. JD, you come up with a favorite live moment yet?
Yeah. Buddy Guy at the Chicago Music Festival, the Chicago Blues Festival. So Buddy Guy at the Chicago Blues Festival in Grant Park.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That was, I was about 13 years old, maybe a little bit older than that. But I had just started playing. I'd only been playing guitar for a couple of years, and like I don't remember much because I was so blown away.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But just, you know, this sea of people in Grant Park in, you know, downtown Chicago, Buddy Guy in his hometown, yeah, absolutely destroying. And like, I don't remember anything. I just like, it's one of those things where it's one of those things where I just remember waves of it.
Yeah.
But it's just
a feeling
walking away. Yeah. The feeling, the overall feeling of what happened. So, well,
and he's one of the guitar players that you'd really have to put up there in the influential category.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And, especially I think his live music, he just had something, his presence was somehow, I feel like, hard to record. And maybe it was just the recording.
Well, and that's
the time or something.
Well, but that's the thing. Like, he's such a live performer.
Yeah.
And he's, I mean, that's what he was known for. He would back in the clubs in Chicago, you know, I'd read interviews with him where he'd buy basically the longest guitar cable he could get so he could walk on stage. He could walk on top of the bar. He'd walk out the front of the door of the club.
Yeah.
Cause he'd buy like these 100-foot guitar cables. And then, so he could just do that. He could do that just to put on a show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was playing wireless. I was fortunate enough to see him play with BB King in Louisville. I think it was a Valentine's Day show. He was completely wireless and actually walked out into the crowd and walked all around the seating, and it was fantastic. Such a showman.
He used to do that with Junior when he played with Junior Wells. Like, there's this shot of him doing that at the Ann Arbor Blues Festival that they had for a couple of years in like the late 60s, and he had like 100-foot cable, and they're just going through the crowd, and there's like, you can see like the shot of him is from like, you know, shoulders up, but kind of in the back you can almost see like a roadie like holding the guitar cables, like, oh, keeping God. The cables.
You're on cable duty today. Fuck.
Yeah. So last time we talked, G, I told him about seeing Daikaiju and how their drummer was being held aloft, and like, he and his entire drum set were crowd surfing. And yeah. It's still one of the, you know, just most fun, mind boggling things I've seen at a show.
It's they've done that a couple of times. I saw pictures of them somewhere. They played somewhere and there was like a roof, and they basically were able to lift them onto like this awning, kind of like a little overhang,
sort of a mezzanine.
And it was outside, like they took them outside, and it was I think it may have been in Europe somewhere, but it was just
took them on the balcony. That's awesome. Those guys are like they're in the moment, and I don't know if I've ever quite gotten to the point when performing live that I've lost myself that much, you know, that I would just be able to go with the flow of whatever. I mean, I would say yes, as far as getting into the music that I'm playing, but not so much being able to simultaneously do that with the music and also interact with everyone. And
right. Cause sometimes it takes a lot of concentration. I mean, as a drummer for me, this is one of the reasons I never really excelled at like singing and playing the drums at the same time, is I'm really in my head about what I'm playing, what's happening next, and like just trying to keep it together and not fuck shit up. So, you know, you have a lot to concentrate on, let alone like your environment interacting with you.
Yeah, I think to some extent you got to be not afraid to just screw up a little bit, but keep it going, you know?
Yeah. I was always too scared of that.
Yeah. Well, that is a skill in its own right. And then the showmanship on top of that is
a lot.
Something that's really, really just incredible to witness.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to have to go in a little while. So,
yeah, I think we should probably wrap it up.
Yeah, thanks for chatting with us, JD.
No problem.
Absolutely.
Feel free to edit me out as much as possible.
No way, man.
We're going to edit me out and keep JD, actually. No, I really appreciate your wealth of knowledge in the music area.
Yeah, it's nice having that. Your insights when it comes to different musicians who are like, I know a little bit about, but I'm always wanting to hear more stories about them.
Yeah, and I'm always fuzzy on the details about everything.
The amount of real knowledge I've pushed out of my head to occupy with, you know, things like Jimmy Page played on a lot of the Kinks' early albums, or the early singles.
Yeah, same. I feel like the same with Matt and I, just with different music.
Yeah, a lot of times that's what's great about, you know, talking to my friends who also know a lot about music. I feel like we'll have some overlap, but then it also just like, I'm amazed at, wow, how did you know that about that person? Like... Yeah. I wouldn't have thought to look into that. So that's the fun aspect of this, is just sharing those anecdotes, stories. Like, I've got so many great concert stories that I want to get to at some point.
Yeah. And we will. We'll bring it back.
Yeah. But that's the thing about this. It's going to be kind of a shuffle, random journey. So join us for the ride.
Yeah, that's why we do this. And we'd love to have you back again sometime, JD. So
cool.
Right on. Okay. Well, I guess I just want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Peace.